Thanks. Hello, everyone. Everyone can hear me well? Okay, good. Thank you for the introduction. So I'm the first one, and I'm going to talk generally about WebKit quite a lot, and then later on in the sessions we go into more depths about WebKit. And one of the goals of my talk is to try to demystify a little bit WebKit and basically try to encourage people to actually contribute to WebKit, because it's not rocket science. It's possible. This is a developer conference, so I'm really hoping that by the end of the session you have a sense of how can you actually contribute to WebKit and what are the opportunities for you as a developer to get into WebKit. So a few words about who I am. I'm leading a WebKit team at Samsung, and I've been a WebKit reviewer since 2009. I've been involved with WebKit around 2006. And this is where you can find me. So a little bit more about the agenda and what I'm trying to achieve here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of WebKit. I think this is a very important background to remind us that WebKit has evolved over time and is going to continue to evolve over time with a rapid pace. And then I'm going to talk in a little bit more detail about how you can actually get involved with WebKit, what specific areas you can contribute and get yourself involved. And then to tie up that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the architecture of WebKit, so that everybody can find a piece or a component that's passionate, that you are passionate about. And then I'm going to talk about future challenges, sort of hot topics that I think is going to be important for the web and WebKit to evolve. And, you know, if you could help with those, that's great. Wasn't me, yeah. All right, so why do we have a full track just on WebKit in a Tizen conference, right? So Tizen is an open source operating system that's designed to run web applications or designed to run applications from the web ecosystem. I didn't use the word HTML5. As Dom mentioned, maybe 2 years from now it's going to be HTML6 or more. Again, the idea here is the web. So if you want to run web applications, we need an engine that is capable of doing that. And the choice of engine for Tizen 2.1 is WebKit. So WebKit powers the Tizen browser, and it also powers the web runtime. So what is WebKit? WebKit is an open source project as well, and it is essentially just the layout engine that enables others and to create web browsers. So it's not really a browser itself. It's kind of just an engine. It's a library. All right. So we're going to talk a little bit about history. But before that, just a little bit about the size of the project and just to have an idea of what WebKit is and just to scope the project a little bit. So it's a 12-year-old project, which is pretty long, especially in this rapid pace of technology development that we're living right now. In that 12 years, it had about 150,000 commits and about 120,000 bugs fired. So that's a pretty crazy number if you ask me. But more importantly, let's just look at last year. So last year, it's about 35,000 commits, and if we break that down, that's about one commit every 15 minutes. So basically, by the time I'm done with this speech, there will be 3 changes in WebKit. And so good luck following all that. And you know, it's not just 8 hours a day the way we work. It's basically 24 hours a day, day and night. And again, the bug number is pretty close to the commit number. I think that's mostly how WebKit, that shows how WebKit works. Essentially, everything is a bug, including features. So every time you contribute to WebKit, you open a bug, you discover what you want to change, and then you attach the code to it. The repository size is 4 GB, but this includes tests and test expectations. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. The number of deaths is about 35,000. And if we just kind of look at the actual core source, which is generally C and C++, it's about 1.7 million lines. So it's, I mean, it's not exactly like a Linux kernel, but it's pretty comparable to that. There's no official releases of WebKit. There's no such a thing as WebKit 3.5 or anything like that. Instead, what we have is the port themselves have releases. And of course, browser have releases. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about what those are. So let's then actually talk about the history. So the whole project started not as WebKit, but as KHTML, as part of the KDE project. It's from 98. And then Apple picked it up for the Safari browser development. And they released WebCore and JavaScript Core as an open source components. And then 2 years later, they actually opened the WebKit project. They open sourced a little bit more. And they actively set up the infrastructure that we rely today. They set up the wiki. They set up the bug system, IRC, so on and so forth. 2006 is an important milestone. I think that's the first mobile browser that's based on WebKit. Before, it was all desktop. I think WebKit is doing very well in desktop, but on mobile, it's basically dominating even today. So, and then a year later, we had the iPhone and the Android browser, Qt WebKit, so on and so forth. One thing you notice, I have these links in my slides. That's, I encourage you to visit those and look at them after the presentation. That has a lot more details about what I'm talking about. So that's actually a YouTube video about with Lars talking about the good old days, who is essentially one of the key developers of KHTML. So a little bit more recent history. 2008 is when Google got involved with the project for desktop, and they released Google Chrome initially just for Windows. The significance of this is the multi-processor architecture that they introduced. 2010, another mobile browser from Samsung, Dolphin, and then BlackBerry 6. And like I mentioned, almost every mobile device is based on WebKit these days. 2010, that's when Apple basically follows Google's lead and adds the multi-processor architecture to WebKit. But they did it slightly differently than Google. Google added it to sort of to the browser outside of WebKit, whereas WebKit 2 is inside the WebKit project. And it's there for others to reuse as well, which is exactly what happened. In 2011, Nokia released a WebKit 2-based browser in a phone called N9. And then a few key events. In 2012, Google announced that they're going to basically harmonize their Chrome desktop and Android forks into one, and they're going to all upstream it into webkit.org. That was a big commitment to WebKit itself to get all that support into one project. This year, Opera announced that they're going to go with Chrome as well, and they're going to discontinue their own engine development. And then I don't know if you guys noticed, but also recently Apple announced that they're going to put the iOS port of WebKit into webkit.org as well. This is also something that wasn't on really open source in the trunk. And then a few months back, 6 weeks back, Google announced that they're going to essentially split the project, and they announced Blink. So as you can see, in every year we have major events in the lifetime of the project, and I don't expect to be next year to be different. I think this sort of change is going to continue. So what are the active WebKit ports at the moment? This is a list. You can go through them. I guess one thing I would highlight is, or a few things I would highlight is that EFL port is the port for Tizen. And then at the end, as you can see, Chromium is no longer there. It's basically no longer a port of WebKit. It's essentially a separate project called Blink. There's a new port up and coming. It's called Nix. It's not really on the trunk yet. The idea of Nix is that it's going to be optimized for Linux and OpenGL, and it's going to minimize the dependencies of external libraries. And again, there's a link where you can perhaps learn a little bit more about it. Just perhaps I didn't explain what a port is. So you can think of WebKit just a set of source code, and then depending on what you build from it, you get a port. So when you actually build WebKit, you have to specify that I want to build this specific port of WebKit. Without specifying that, you don't really have anything. You just have a bunch of source code. So this talk is about WebKit and not Blink, but I still want to touch on a little bit of how Blink impacted WebKit. So after the announcement, the WebKit project started to essentially remove parts of the code that was only there to support Chromium. So this includes support for Android itself, support for Skia, which is a graphics backend that was used by Chromium, and V8, which is the JavaScript library that was used by Google. We also removed a bunch of test expectations for Chromium. And with that, we in the last 6 weeks, we actually removed about 2 gigabytes of data from the WebKit repository, which is pretty massive. So like I mentioned, the size of the repository is now 4 gigabytes. So just 2 months ago, it was 6 gigabytes. In terms of actual C++ code removed, it's about 170,000 lines of code, which is still significant. It's about 10% of the project. I think one thing that this shows is that even though the Chromium project was really together with the rest of the WebKit ports, it was quite significantly different than other ports. A port typically doesn't involve putting 10% of code into WebKit. I think this number is so massive because the Chromium architecture was so significantly different from other WebKit ports, which is also something that Google used as an explanation why they went with Blink. But Google is still involved with WebKit. They review a few patches. I think they're still very much interested to making sure that the web is not fragmented. So key bug fixes that are important for compatibility of the web are still cross-posted between WebKit and Blink, not necessarily by the same authors. So that's how much I wanted to talk about Blink. Back to WebKit. We have two social layers, or basically three, when you get involved with WebKit. When you start contributing, you essentially don't really have a status in the project. And then once you reach about 10 to 20 patches and you get to know, or people get to know you a little bit in the community, then a reviewer would nominate you, and then if you get enough support, then you would become a committer. This is something that's fairly easy to get. So, you know, if you're really committed to WebKit, you should be able to become a committer in 2-3 months easily. And this is something I encourage people to try if this is something if you want to get involved with WebKit. At the moment, we have about 270 committers that are not reviewers. I would say that's a fairly large number. It shows that this is truly an open source, a successful open source project. Reviewers are the people that are essentially running the project and governing it. They not only approve committers and new reviewers, they also essentially approve every single change that actually lands in the project. So when you propose a change, it has to be reviewed by a reviewer, and then it will go in. At the moment, we have 130 reviewers, but not everybody is active. Probably the active number of reviewers is more like 50, 80 or so. This is the distribution of reviewed commits last year. Unfortunately, the data is a little bit old, but at the same time, it doesn't really make sense to measure this sort of stuff in a month-by-month basis because there's a large fluctuation. I want to highlight two things. I think one of them is before the Blink announcement, how much of the contribution actually came from Google. It's basically 50% of the project. Secondly, I want to highlight that sort of key Tizen companies and the contribution of Tizen to WebKit is not very significant. And I think, you know, this is something we can improve, and this is part of the talk that I'm hoping that, you know, next year I can show much, much better numbers. So, okay, how can you get involved, like very specifically? So one thing that doesn't immediately occur to people, but we need a lot of tests, not just WebKit, but basically the entire web, and with that W3C. So, you know, some of the standards are not progressing well because they don't have enough test coverage. Also, W3C is getting essentially setting up a lot of infrastructure to make it easier to people to contribute tests. Because frankly, if we have a really, really good test coverage, we don't even need specification. We can just tell people that, you know, pass these tests and that's it. So they put all their tests to GitHub, and essentially they have a GitHub review process for welcoming W3C tests. Now, how does that relate to WebKit? So if you contribute tests to W3C, then WebKit's going to take them, and WebKit's going to run them, and then essentially we are running your code. And not only WebKit will run them, but other browsers will run them. So to have the biggest impact on testing, you should probably try to get into W3C. And again, I have some good links about some specific details. Now, if for whatever reason your test is only for WebKit, then it's going to end up under this layout test directory. It's a terrible name. Essentially, it's a regression test suite, and it's not a conformance test suite. So it is full of tests that are testing things like, if I do this and this and this, then the browser shouldn't crash. Because probably what happened is that at some point the browser did crash. And then when that bug was fixed, together with the fix, we had an actual test case that was added to this regression test suite. A few pointers about how can you actually, or what is a good test case, and how does this whole infrastructure works. So how can you specifically help? Again, you could try to basically convert some of these WebKit tests to be more generic W3C tests. You could try to remove duplicated tests. There's a very specific WebKit bug about importing about an infrastructure of importing W3C tests into WebKit, and this is very fresh. So like you could go home today and basically start doing this, and a bunch of other people are doing this, and they would really appreciate your help. If just writing tests is not your cup of tea, you can just basically file bugs. And depending on where you found the bug and where you think the fix should go, they layers to actually file the bugs. So, you know, once Tizen product hits the market, it's conceivable that you want to file bugs for the Tizen browser. But you should only do that if you have enough proof and evidence that bug is only in Tizen. If you think that's a generic WebKit bug that's on iPhone as well and perhaps Android and other places, then you should file it in WebKit. And then lastly, if you think that, oh gosh, this API doesn't do what I want it to do, and I really think that everybody is wrong and I'm right, and then try to convince W3C to change the spec. So, okay, I want you to file more bugs, but what about the existing bugs? Well, we have quite a lot of them. So we actually have like 17,000 bugs open, and these are just the open bugs. And that's a lot. So, and because of that, no one actually like tries to fix them because it's just too many. But we, on the other hand, we cannot just close them either, because even though some of them are really old, they're actually still relevant. So just to make that point, for example, Opera fixed a bug just like back in February that was filed in 2007. And it was important that we fixed them. So you could, what you can do, you could basically look at these open bugs, you can try to prioritize them, you can try to combine them, you can see which one's still reproducible, so on and so forth. And again, people would really appreciate if you do that. And it counts as a contribution to the project. But of course, as developers, most people are interested still to contribute code. So with that, you obviously have to learn a little bit more about the project and the policies. But one thing that you really need to remember, that this is a test event project, test event development. So if you come and do a change and with that you break a test, that means that you didn't really understand that this is a test event development project. So these are roughly the steps you're going to have to go through to contribute code to WebKit. Once you made your change and tested it locally, then you can run a script that tells you if you're violating the coding style guide of WebKit. And that's a link if you want to read it. Then we have some really cool automated system that can, before a human looks at your code, it can basically tell bad things about your code before a human spends a lot of time trying to tell you that this is bad. One of that we call an early warning system. So basically, when you upload your patch to WebKit, then this warning system kicks in, and it's going to build WebKit with your change, and it's going to test WebKit with your change. And it's going to tell you if something went wrong. And then you iterate with the community for, and you discuss the details of your patch. Eventually, you get a review plus. A reviewer would say that, okay, this is good. You're still not really done, because you have to actually, or once the code checked in, you really need to watch the billboards to make sure that you didn't introduce regressions, because unfortunately, some tests are only run after your code is checked in. So we have levels of testing. When you contribute code, make sure that you do your homework, you understand what other browsers are doing in that area, what the spec says. Check the history of the code that you're changing. Make sure that you understand what was done before you went there. And then there's a bunch of stuff that essentially, again, very much welcomed, and it's fairly easy to do. So, for example, we still have a lot of dead code, not necessarily just because of Chromium, but just the way the project evolved. There's a bunch of fix me's that they're not relevant anymore, or it's easy to do. Like we would have fix me's that please rename this class to something else. And if you know C++, then you can do that. And that's a really effective way to actually learn about the code. So, okay, let's talk architecture. Essentially, we have a few layers. The bottom layer is WTF. It stands for Web Template Framework. Essentially, it's a utility library. So it has basic data structures like map and lists and threading abstractions and so on and so forth. On top of that, we have the JavaScript core, which is the JavaScript engine for WebKit. And on the other side, we have a platform abstraction that is used to abstract away sort of differences in ports. And WebCore is the most important component of WebKit. It's essentially the component that implements HTML5 and HTML, CSS, DOM, so on and so forth. And on top of that, there's the binding layer that basically connects WebCore and JavaScript Core. So JavaScript Core really just implements the JavaScript as a language. It doesn't implement, for example, scripting for the DOM. or scripting for CSS. That's all bound together in this binding layer. And then WebKit is the facade on top of this whole engine. And then together with that is this WebKit 2, which I will talk a little bit more about it later. This is a fairly important concept as well. So in the platform layer, there is this concept of graphics context, which basically abstracts away graphics in the project. And you can see that different ports are using different graphics backends. Safari is using Core Graphics from Mac. Qt is using QPainter. And the EFF port, which is the port we use for Tizen, is using Cairo. So basically WebKit is using Cairo to paint. And you'll see these bubbles here. That's basically points to upcoming talks. That goes more in details about accelerated rendering with graphics, with Cairo and quality of rendering in WebKit. So I encourage you to attend those. This is to show what WebKit 2 is. WebKit 2 is essentially abstracts away this process separation between the web process and UI process. So that the embedder, the application, doesn't really need to understand that it talks to two processes. It really just talks to one process, and then the whole marshalling and inter-process communication happens within WebKit. This is a picture about a life cycle of a page. As the data comes in, it hits the loader, and then the parsers. And then from the parsers, it's building a rendering tree. From the rendering tree, we put together layers that gets painted through the graphics context. Loading is split between WebCore and WebKit. And essentially, we have two different core passes, one to load mainframes and iframes, another one to load every other resources. This picture shows it better. So the two green boxes, frame loader and dock loader, are the most important interfaces or classes for loading. And there's a pointer to read up on this more. This is the state machine for loading. I think it's very important to understand this as well. The very first stage is the policy stage. This is where we essentially make a decision whether this load is allowed or denied. And this decision is typically delegated to the application. So the application would make a decision whether we want to block pop-ups or not. And then we have the provisional phase where we make a decision whether this is a download or something that's content that needs to be rendered. And then when the load is committed, meaning that we know that we're going to essentially navigate forward and we have enough data from the server to make that happen, then we start parsing. WebKit has various caches. I'm not going to go into much details on that. This is how parsing happens. It's very typical parsing, except that we have to parse HTML, which is not proper XML, and so there's a lot of quirks to that, and the output of the parsing is the DOM tree. From the DOM tree, once we have the DOM tree, then we look at CSS. And we look at which actual nodes needs to be painted. And then from those nodes, we build the rendering render tree. So if a node doesn't need to be painted, it doesn't actually show up in the render tree. And from the render tree, we organize the elements that needs to be rendered into rendered layers. And each layer is essentially composited at the end. And so in this example, what you can see is that we have an image that fixed positioned. So to essentially accelerate, for example, scrolling and painting of that fixed element, we put it in a separate layer. Then everything else goes to the main layer, and then it's much easier to composite. So if this is not exciting for you enough yet, then I have a few more current challenges that essentially the web community is trying to solve. One of them is what actually goes into one process. So initially the whole browser and everything was one process. And then Chrome introduced the renderer process. Currently there is discussion about just having a process for networking with WebKit 2. Chrome has a GPU process. And then, again, there's a lot of talk about having processes just for iframes. So even though you'll have one page, if it has several iframes, then the page itself would then launch several processes. And then again, the pointers here are very important to get a little bit more background. I talk a little bit about my understanding of the trade-offs involved of the process model. And there's a talk coming up about just security and process isolation that talks a little bit about the benefits of process isolation. I think another current challenge is API design. It's actually really hard to design APIs for the web, especially device APIs. Because the nature of the device API is that it's specific for a particular device. On the other hand, you want it to be cross-platform. I want to leave a little bit of time for questions, so I'm jumping through a little faster at the end. Lastly, together with the API, I think the whole security model is very important and very challenging. You know, when do you prompt a user? Do you have an installation phase in your web runtime? Do you have perhaps separate trust levels and you only allow certain applications at certain trust levels? These are all very current questions where you're trying to push the web to where the native platform is, you're going to run into those. So if you have thoughts on this, you know, join the discussion, join the W3C mailing list, come to WebKit and let's have a discussion. So as a conclusion, I think hacking on WebKit is a lot of fun, and I really hope that everybody would be so excited to hack on WebKit as I am. And depending on your technical level or your commitment, I think there is work for everyone on WebKit. And lastly, if you really want to influence web, you want to influence Tizen, you want to influence what the next version of web is, the best way to do that is to contribute to upstream projects. Whether that's the WebKit project or the Tizen project or perhaps the WCC specification itself, the point is that you try to do that upstream and have the biggest impact as possible. And with that, this is the end of my talk, and I'm going to open it up for questions. Please.
With Blink, do you see Tizen switching over or staying with WebKit?
Sorry, I cannot hear you.
With Blink being forked out, do you see Tizen sticking with WebKit or Blink within the next 1 to 2 years?
I don't know. So, like I said, this talk is about WebKit. Blink still a 6 weeks old project. I mean, to say something about that is really hard, I think. Also, what perhaps not everybody understood is that when Blink born, essentially, the very first day Blink had WebKit was exactly the same. So, even though now we are 6 weeks into Blink, you can sort of say that it's still very much the same as WebKit, right? So I think to answer that question, one needs to speculate where Blink is going to be in a year from now, and I can't really do that. At the same time, you also need to speculate where WebKit is going to be a year from now, and which is what I was trying to do, right?
On Android, the Java developer can extend their application with native code through JNI. I wonder what you see as preferred ways for a JavaScript developer to extend a Tizen web application with native code.
So the best way, which is I think also somewhat the hardest way, is that you extend JavaScript right in WebKit. And then it's not there for Tizen, but it's there for everyone. Specifically on Tizen, I'm not the best person to answer that. Frankly, I think maybe Ming can talk a little bit more later in her WebRun, in your WebRun time update presentation. I think on a keynote there was a mention about adding native components into and essentially create a hybrid environment for Tizen applications. But maybe you can cover that.
So related to the earlier question, there's also the Google V8 JavaScript engine and the JavaScript core and WebKit. How do you see those? Do you see them diverging more or, I guess, becoming one?
No. So I see them diverging more. How exactly that happened, that's hard to say. But so before recently, right, WebKit essentially supported both V8 and JavaScript core. And with that, there was a little bit of work of making sure that the same code can work with both. Now with the recent change, essentially WebKit will only work with JavaScript core. So if for some reason JavaScript core is so much better than V8 or vice versa, then basically with your engine choice, you also have to go with the corresponding layout engine because you don't really have an option to switch back and forth.
Hi. With Samsung stepping up with the contributions to WebKit, where do you see the focus, mostly like device APIs, graphics rendering, you know, CSS transitions, graphical effects? And then connected to that, I don't know if you're aware of a project from Mozilla called Osm.js, where they basically have some math-intensive libraries where they highly optimize the JavaScript engine to be very, very fast, which would be great for things like games.
Right. So to the first question, where Samsung is planning to contribute to WebKit, I think it's generally across the board. We care deeply about performance and optimization for hardware, so I think we're going to see some of that. At the same time, I think we're going to step up and do a lot more code maintenance as well. I think that has been a feedback from the WebKit project as a larger, that a lot of the maintenance was driven by Apple, for example, whereas other contributors were either pushing their agenda with ports or pushing their agenda for certain new APIs. And I think to be a bit more effective part of the community, we need to also step up with perhaps not set interesting work, but the kind of work I mentioned in my presentation, tests, fix-me's, infrastructure, that sort of stuff. So I expect that Samsung will do more of that as well. And your other question about performance, JavaScript engine performance, I think we're looking at use cases, and I could perhaps introduce you to Simon. So Samsung has a few projects where we're trying to address some of the very specific use cases instead of doing a really fast general computation in JavaScript. So I think one of them is WebCL, where we're trying to really take advantage of the GPU. And that's an open source project from Samsung. Yes, please.
Sorry.
I think this is going to be the last question.
You have shown us that there's a few contributions from Tizen for WebKit. And we also saw that there's many patches for WebKit in Tizen.org. It's really bad. Either for the Tizen that you have to maintain so much patches, and for the upstream, some fix are not pushed to share the common fix. So what's your personal opinion? Why this happens? And how we should improve the situation? It is caused by the develop model, or caused by that some WebKit committer reviewer inside for Tizen that not involved in the feature development of the Tizen. Could you give us your personal opinion on this?
Sure.
Thank you.
So, just to rephrase the question, I think what I understood is that You're saying that we have a Tizen branch that has some WebKit changes, and how do we manage that, and which one gets upstreamed, and so forth. So my personal opinion is that everybody needs a productization branch. I think that's something that every company does. I think the challenge is to determine how long that productization branch is, and when that comes off from the main line, and how much new development you're doing on that main branch. So my personal opinion is that I'm really hoping that as we go along in this Tizen journey, we're going to do more and more development upstream and less in that productization branch. And that's gonna help us all stand with the community as well. So I think with that, thanks a lot. I appreciate you coming, and again, hack on WebKit.